Okay, thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's always nice to, oh, hello, Zhao. I haven't seen all the faces, now I get to see some of you. So this talk will have some of the same themes that in Mark's talk, just a very different language. So this will be the language of probability theory, dynamical systems. Maybe it's the same language, but it doesn't seem like to me it is. And I guess that's part of the reason for having these kind of workshops. So let me start with a little bit of more broad context. I'm viewed as a machine learning researcher. I actually don't like that terminology. I'm a statistician and sometimes a computer scientist, but you know, statistician, inference and all. I think that we've had a number of applied successes. They're often called machine learning, and even worse, they're now being called AI, which I think is just a complete misnomer. Don't get me started on that. But I just do want to give a little context of the, not the academic side, but the applied side, because this is an applied field. We're not just mathematicians. We're trying to do something out in the real world. And so already in the 1990s, there was a really, you know, $1 billion industry created on the basis of data analysis at large scale. And so Amazon is a good example of having done that. They did fraud detection extremely well. If you're going to do online commerce, you have to do fraud detection extremely well. So get the error rates down below 0.01% to have any hope. And they did that with random forests. Supply chain management, if you're serving billions of products to hundreds of millions of people, every product is built out of pieces, you have to model all those pieces, how they come across the oceans, across the trains and all that, and whether they're going to be there on time or not. It's all probability, and it's all in some sense just operations research, but done in a completely new scale. That was already being done, and Amazon would not be Amazon without having done that. So having built systems that do that, they said, well, we have all this data on customers too. Can we use the same kind of ideas to serve customers? And the next generation, I think it was turning the algorithms towards the human side. So recommendation systems, another very, very important technology. It's not neural nets. It's not the sexy thing of the year. It's not AI, but it really, really drove billion-dollar industries. So you know, just simple recommendations. Some people come in, and if we have overlap, we offer the same products to other people. The generation I think we're in right now, people are, you know, there's so much talk about, I think is the pattern recognition era. So deep neural nets are just pattern recognition, okay? It's just pattern recognition with gradient descent, okay? And it's not decision, there's a whole other side of statistics which is called decision making. And neural nets are not decision making, okay? Decision making has to do with making many decisions simultaneously, having error rates under control, making sequence of decisions, and so on and so forth. It's a whole field of its own. And it's being omitted right now in most of the work and most of the language. Self-driving cars, control theory, and neural net's a little piece. There's a pattern recognition piece inside of there to take all the images and turn them into something that you can use. But that something is not the decision. The decision about whether to push the accelerator or the brake, that's hard, on top of the neural net. Okay, but think about not just one self-driving car. This is the point I'll get to later. Think about a million self-driving cars all together on the streets. That's the real problem, okay? And there you have to have decision-making deluxe. You have to have all kinds of interacting decisions. And that's not the part that's been the focus, but that really is AI. In fact, I think that what we're having emerging right now is we're moving past the neural net age, I hope. We're returning to decisions as well as pattern recognition, putting it all together and thinking about networks, and not just networks, but markets. This is about actually having not my decision be independent of everybody else's, that I get what I want and I predict something, but mine interacts with everybody, because there's usually scarcity in the real world. And you have to take that into account when you actually build real world systems. So people talk a lot about scarcity and fairness now as if it's a broken aspect of current AI or machine learning. It just means you have to bring economic principles to bear, okay? So I'm gonna not give that talk, I'm gonna give a different talk, which is more about the underlying algorithmic and mathematical issues and challenges. I'm going to talk about saddle points, dimension dependence with rates. I'm going to talk about lower bounds, statistics meets optimization. I do want to talk about sampling. As Mark alluded to, optimization and sampling are often present in our goals in this world. And then I really want to hopefully get to a little bit to market design. Here, we're talking about saddle points as well in high-dimensional spaces, but we don't want to avoid the saddle points, we want to go to them. They're the equilibria that we want to go to in an economic sense. And there are brand new issues here, all kinds of really interesting. I think this is going to be huge in the next two or three decades. Okay, let me just give you a little bit of a aperitif. I'm going to show you a result that I'm going to get to at the very end of the talk, and this required some new mathematics, and it's a new kind of, it's a surprising result. To get to this result, it required a whole sequence of steps, and that's what the rest of the talk is going to be about, some of the steps that allowed us to perceive that this was a possible result. So we're going to compare sampling and optimization in this result. That's kind of not been done very much. Those are two completely separate technologies. Optimization has rates, they often have dimension dependence, and there's been a lot of good theory on that in the last 10 years, very, very active. I would say MCMC is older, but it has fewer rates, there's not dimension dependence, it's asymptotic typically, and it hasn't been active in the last 10 years, really. Now, can you compare them? Is that kind of apples and oranges? Well, to some extent, yes, but I'm going to show you a result that kind of gets around that. And I want to acknowledge Yian Ma, who came in and started working on this. He has a strong background in stochastic processes and physics. And so he asked, is this kind of statement really true? Is sampling just necessarily slower than optimization? No one's proved that. Can we put some mathematics to this? So here's the result. So first of all, let's get a definition. Here's the definition we're going to use for mixing time. So we have a stochastic process of some kind indexed by K. It's going to approach an equilibrium and total variation up to some ball. Let's call that the mixing time, the time to reach the ball. And I'm going to briefly, this is not the main part of the talk, but just allude to two algorithms here. There's an unadjusted Langevin, which is just good old Langevin, discretized, and then there's a Metropolis adjusted where you accept reject. Okay, so these are two things that have been studied in the literature. Total variation. I'm not in a math audience here, I guess. This is a physics audience. Sampling. So here's a theorem. I don't want to get into unpacking all this. I just want to give you a highlight. This is kind of to get you intrigued by the talk. All right, so we're going to assume that we have a function which is non-convex. It's going to be strongly convex outside of a ball of size R, but inside of that, it's only Lipschitz smooth. So inside of the ball, it can have lots of bumps, but just not this kind of bumps. Okay? So think mixture model or frustrated system, but with a prior on that. So outside, the prior kicks in and we get strong convexity, but inside that we have quite, you know, serious structure. Okay, so this kind of thing has been studied. It's not completely new to study, but these are new rates. So let me just focus on Metropolis adjusted Langevin. Let's skip over that for now. A lot of constants here, which I think are many of them the right constants. In terms of the epsilon ball, this is actually a linear algorithm. Its rate is 1 over epsilon logarithm, okay? So it's for this particular problem, Metropolis-adjusted Langevin is highly efficient. But the main point I want to focus on is the d. So d to the 3 halves, d to the 1 half, this is polynomial, d squared in dimension of this underlying problem, okay? D is dimension, it's going to be dimension throughout the talk. Okay, so this is diffusing in total variation distance to its equilibrium, and it's doing so at a relatively fast rate, okay? So that's kind of some log-Sobolev machinery. This is the mixing time for a particular algorithm. This is the Metropolis-adjusted Langevin. That's the mixing time for the unadjusted Langevin. But I don't want to get into that one. Let me just focus on this one. All right. These kind of results are not, there are other results like this. In fact, the French school, Dermius, Moulin, and so on, have been doing things like this, okay? That you can get mixing. Now, this is not the convex world, however. This is non-convex, but it's kind of locally non-convex. All right, here's the surprise, is if you take this exact same problem, and you say, I'm going to allow myself any optimization algorithm that looks at function values, gradients, and even higher order derivatives up to some order. For any such algorithm, there's a lower bound which says the complexity is exponential in dimension for this problem. Okay, so k, where is k? K is the number of steps of this algorithm. Okay, so the number of steps is going to be lower bounded by something which goes exponentially in dimension. All right, so optimization here is getting hung up in all the little local bumps, all right? Whereas Langevin is sailing across the local bumps, hitting the non-convex, the strong convex region, and mixing quickly, okay? And then running back in and coming. Okay, so that's a real result, yeah. Yes, sampling at zero temperature, you think of as optimization, okay? And so true, intuitively that, you know, there's...
Perhaps the yeah.
Yeah, the exponential, it's not, in some sense, surprising. There's a non-convex problem where exponential dependence in dimension kicks in. That's certainly been known. It's an NP-hard problem, right? But in the same problem that you get exponential dependence there and you get polynomial, low-degree polynomial for Langevin, that's new. That's surprising. Okay, and these are about all the constants there. These are kind of condition number type constants. There's no asymptotics and no hidden constants. Okay, so I want to, that paper is up on the archive, it's just a couple of weeks old. I want to move up to that, I'm going to return to that. Yeah. Yeah. No, it converges in total variation distance to an equilibrium distribution. And I want to know the time it takes to converge to equilibrium distribution.
So the temperature is low enough that equilibrium distribution will sit on the optimum.
No, it's just trying, no, there's no temperature here. We just have a function, e to the minus u. And u is a particular function. There is a Lipschitz constant, and there is a region, a ball R. We have a second section of the paper saying, okay, if you want to try to do that, it will not save you. Okay, the Langevin will become exponential as you lower the temperature. So we have a little section on that. Okay.
It's not a contradiction.
Yeah. No. Thank you. Thank you for interpreting. I assume you're going to be doing more of that. Okay. So as we go, I want to build up kind of to the machinery we needed to kind of prove this kind of thing, and especially getting the dimension dependence, because that is really critical. If you don't get the dimension dependence, we're not in the brave new world of hundreds of thousands of dimensions. Okay. If you just give rates or even especially asymptotics, you're not doing the hard work. So this paper really got us started. Qi Jianzi is still a grad student with me, and I have various other colleagues I want to acknowledge here. And I'm going to go quickly on a bunch of these sections. I hope that it'll not be too quick. Please stop and ask questions, by the way. I don't like questions only at the end. I like them during the talk. So let's just talk about saddle points. We're doing optimization now in this part of the talk. I'll turn to diffusion later. There are lots of problems where saddle points is the key. In fact, we used to think for things like neural nets that it was the local minima which were the problem, and it's sort of seeming more and more true that you can avoid local minima. You know, Jason Lee has very nice results. I think Adi's worked on some various other people. That it's not so much the local minima, it's the saddle points. There's large numbers of them, and you tend to get stuck for long periods of time, or you could potentially, right? And if you see a neural net being trained, it kind of comes down quickly, then it flattens out for a while, then it comes down quickly again, and that's hitting kind of rings of saddle points. So you'd like to quantify in high dimensions what's the dimension dependence on escape from saddle points. There also are, by the way, lots of non-convex problems that have a single global optimum, but lots of saddle points. So there, the whole point is the saddle points. All right. So in three dimensions, it doesn't look like very much, but what about in high dimensions? So here's a little bit of background. Kind of a consequence of Morse theory, but done in discrete time. And we had a paper in 2017 showing that gradient ascent will asymptotically avoid saddle points. This was known for gradient flow for a long, long time, but it was not known for a gradient descent. But that's an asymptotic result. And in fact, there's a negative result, which shows that gradient ascent could take exponential time to escape saddle points. Yeah, gradient flow is in continuous time, and gradient ascent is in discrete time. At the same time, there was a positive result by Gu et al. Showing that if you add stochasticity to gradient ascent, you could actually escape saddle points in polynomial time, right? But it wasn't known what the polynomial was. It could be d to the 45th, and at some point someone got a result which was d to the 3rd, but that's still not good. D is 100,000 or million. You really would like to know why are neural nets or whatever working so well. It has to be not just d to the 3rd. Well, you do. I mean, you know, so there. Yeah, not always. No, definitely not always, right? But provably these problems with the single global optimum, you can actually watch them move past the saddle points, and they stick there. Yeah. So for convex case, here's gradient descent. Of course, there is a theorem due to Nesterov, but others before that, which says the gradient descent finds the global optimum. But here's the key: is that it finds it in a number of dimensions. Iterations, which is independent of dimension. So that's kind of surprising about gradient descent. You can run it in infinite dimensions, and it takes as many steps as it does in finite dimensions. So that's already kind of part of the mystery. How do you quantify this? Well, here's a rate. This is a Lipschitz constant. Here's initial distance to the optimum. We have a notion of a first-order stationary point, which is the gradient doesn't vanish, but it's you put an epsilon ball around the vanishing of the gradient, and you ask how long does it take to hit the epsilon ball. And then you do that for various epsilon. It gives us a rate. And that rate is 1 over epsilon squared. Okay? It's a very well-known classical result. Right, but now, what if you run gradient descent on this object? It could easily hit a local maximum. It could hit a saddle point and stop. It could take a long period of time to avoid those kind of objects. So how do we, first of all, characterize the ones we care about, and what's the rate? Okay, so the characterization, this is also standard. is that you talk about now second order stationarity. The gradient nearly vanishes, but also the minimum eigenvalue of the Hessian is greater than or equal to zero, and then you give yourself a little ball around that, so you talk about a rate, okay? So the standard parameterization, it looks a little bit odd, but it's useful, it's convenient. All right, so here is the algorithm that we analyzed in this particular paper. We've now done this in other ways, but it's just gradient descent, but occasionally there's a perturbation. In this particular case, the simplest kind you can think of, just uniform perturbation of a ball of size R, where I can tell you what R needs to be. And this happens whenever the gradient gets small and only sporadically. And that's a particular setup. So it's sufficient conditions for giving you the rates I'm about ready to show you. It's not necessary. And here are the rates. So there is the rate right up there. So for this now non-convex setting, we're not finding first order stationarity, we're finding second order stationarity. So we're provably avoiding the saddle points. All right. And we're doing that at a rate 1 over epsilon squared again. So we have not slowed down in this setting. And we still have a Lipschitz constant and initial distance to the optimum. And then there's a tilde on O, which is traditionally used to hide dimension dependence. But now let's be honest about it. It is logarithm to the fourth power of the dimension. So it's the Lipschitz parameter of the Hessian. We're having to assume the Hessian is smooth as well as the gradient. Okay. If the Hessian were not smooth around the saddle point, you could jump all around.
Okay.
That's right. We have to define the notion of the thing we want to converge to. We don't want to converge to a saddle point. Its minimum eigenvalue is negative. We want to converge to something more bowl-shaped. So we want the minimum eigenvalue to be less or equal. That's the kind of object we want to converge to. It's not a global statement about the landscape. It's just local at the points we want to converge to. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to be talking a lot about the relationship of continuous and discrete as I go, okay? But let me just say here, this is hard proof. Effectively, this is some series differential geometry around the saddle points of the Hessian is varying, and we have kind of some third and fourth order kind of differential geometry. We are not that good at differential geometry. We couldn't really actually prove this result that way. We could prove a weaker result. But the way we prove this is with probability theory, all right? And so let me just show you a little bit what the proof is like. Here's a saddle point, and in the neighborhood of it, because the Hessian is varying, there is a region, which we call the stuck region, which is that if you're in that, most of your flow is towards the saddle point. If you're out of that, the negative eigenvalue kicks in and most of your flow is to pull you away quickly, exponentially fast. So you need to figure out what's the width of that region to get a rate. Right? So that is in some sense some difference with geometry, but we did this with a coupling argument. So you start conceptually two diffusions that are a distance r apart. And for small r, they will couple and they will flow together. For larger r, they will flow apart. And so there is a phase transition in the coupling time of these two coupled diffusions. And if you can calculate that phase transition, and we could, then you can get an estimate on the width of this object. Okay? If you replace that object with a flat slab, you get those polynomial rates that I talked about before. And to get the logarithmic rates, which is surely much more close to reality, this coupling argument was appropriate. So we've used coupling in sort of all of the work ever since then. It's just turned out to kind of carve away a lot of the complexity by using coupling. Sorry?
So what is the specificity of the process?
The underlying process is just a round ball. Just make sure that you have you see all the possible directions. Okay? And that's definitely not necessary. You could start to think about a more of a stochastic gradient kind of thing where you see some directions at a time and then over time you aggregate. But this was just to try to get the theorem was already hard enough to do it with a ball, so we stuck with a ball. All right, to the analytical technique to get this width is coupled diffusions. It's Brownian motion. That's not the algorithm, that's the analytic. Okay, now, so that result we think is a pretty close to the truth. We don't have a lower bound. I believe it's logarithm. I don't think it's logarithm to the fourth power. That comes out of the particular coupling. But we think it's close to the truth, and indeed all the constants look right, okay? And it's not asymptotic. So when you start to arrive at that point, you want to ask, is this the best we can do? Do we have a lower bound? And rarely is it that gradient algorithms by themselves are the lower bound achieving algorithms, but there's an accelerated form of gradients, which you want to go after. Yeah?
Again, it's not asymptotic, but does this minimal eigenvalue
No, it's we want the minimum eigenvalue to be bigger than or equal to some epsilon ball parameterized by multiplied by rho, multiplied by the constant rho. That's right.
So this is depends on the dimension.
Well, you could make it dependent on the dimension if you chose to. In the problems that I mentioned that have one convex, one global optimum and a lot of saddle points, it doesn't, provably. But you know, it, who knows in neural nets whether you would need to have that eigenvalue have you know, I wouldn't call it asymptotic result, but you might want to have dimension dependence in there. Yeah, yeah, it could be. Okay, so we've been working a great deal on lower bounds in the Nesterov style. So these are accelerated algorithms. They don't just take a gradient, they take two gradients, and they go faster, provably. But moreover, they strip away a lot of inessential constants and let you get more at the phenomenon. And that's kind of what we're going to be trying to do here. We believe that the way to understand these is to go to continuous time. And there's now kind of a number of people in literature having done this. I think it's kind of a shared belief among many of us. Acceleration is taking an algorithm that's in discrete time and going faster. But if you think about hopping among a discrete set of points, what does it mean to go faster? It's just not at all clear. Hopping faster? You need a topology that you can embed the problem in that talks about acceleration. Okay, so we think it's key to go to continuous time. So briefly, this will be a little segment of a much longer talk, and I want to acknowledge Andre and Aisha, who are grad students working with me on this at Berkeley, and then Mike Betancourt joined us at the end to look at a little of the symplectic integrator part of this story. So I just want to say a little bit about going into continuous time and how it kind of allowed everything else we've done after this is also done in continuous time. So coupling to continuous time, we're moving towards diffusions as our analytical tool for this all this work. Okay, so again, here's gradient descent. I've now added the fact proved by the Nesterov school or Demirovsky school that for convex functions, this thing converges at a rate 1 over k. If k is the number of iterations, you'll be within a ball of size 1 over k after k steps. Okay, so that's an interesting fact. Now, if you want to accelerate, is there a notion of acceleration? Well, Nemirovsky at some point said, let's ask if there's a lower bound for these gradient-based algorithms. Is there a fastest algorithm? And that's a very interesting complexity theory question. And so he invented his own complexity theory for this. It wasn't Turing complexity theory, which kind of would allow you to sort of jump to the optimum in one step. He said, I'm going to allow you to look at gradients and all previous gradients, and all your steps have got to be in the linear span of all the gradients. Okay, so it's a machine that can do a certain limited number of things like conjugate gradients and gradient descent, and it can't do everything in the world. Okay, so there's been a rich literature coming from Nemirovsky. Nadi has contributed to that, a whole bunch of others that sort of define different kinds of machines to give you reasonably useful lower bounds. He, in that machine, proved that there is a lower bound of 1 over k squared, so faster. And then somewhat after that, Nesterov came and wrote down an algorithm which achieved a lower bound. This little algorithm is kind of a gradient descent algorithm in a y variable, and then the new x variable is kind of is a linear combination of the previous two y values. So it has a second order flavor, a little oscillatory, if you will, and it provably goes at rate 1 over k squared for the class of convex functions. Yeah. It's set in a particular way by the algorithm. There's a formula. It's like k plus 1 over k plus 3.
It's universal.
It's universal, yeah. Okay, so if you go into continuous time, what starts to happen there? Well, here's gradient flow. It's just a differential equation. If you do gradient flow on the class of convex functions, it will find the global optimum, and it'll do so at a rate, which is 1 over t, corresponding to 1 over k. Right? So it parallels the discrete case. So now you could ask, what if you take the Nesterov two-step algorithm and turn that into a differential equation by taking the step size to zero? And there's many ways to do that, by the way, but the order discretization is one way. And that was done by colleagues at Stanford, Sue Boyd and Candes. Wei J. Su is now Penn. And this differential equation pops out. So it's second order, in fact, no surprise, and it has an interesting damping factor, 3 over t. You can't solve this, but you can sort of say something about its oscillatory behavior and its rate. So its rate is 1 over t squared, corresponding to 1 over k squared. Okay, so we got engaged at this point. Kind of the old physics part of my brain started to come alive. Where does this differential equation come from? Is there an energy principle or a variational principle that delivers it? Or is it just, why is this a good differential equation? Why is this the fastest way to get down the hill? Is there any reason for that? Yeah, Y3, indeed. Okay, so this is a whole separate talk of its own. I gave it at the ICM this summer, and so there's a video on it if you're curious to see that talk. But we found a Lagrangian. Here it is. We called it the Bregman Lagrangian. It is now, we're in continuous time. It's a variational principle, so it's an energy-like function. It's a function of x and x dot. We're in a phase space. You integrate it and minimize, of course, as in a variational calculus. That object up there has a bunch of functions, gamma, alpha, and beta, which are just degrees of freedom to give us a space of algorithms. They aren't important. They're just diffeomorphisms. But the key is the DH, which is called the Bregman divergence. It's kind of a distance measure between where you are now, x, and x plus a time-scaled x dot. So it's a little bit of a kind of elasticity in the direction of motion. If the H in the Bregman divergence is quadratic, then this becomes 1 half x dot squared. And I guess in this building, I don't have to say what that is. So we have a kinetic energy minus, effectively, a potential. It's a Lagrangian. All right. So it will define via the Euler-Lagrange equations a path. And those other Lagrange equations deliver this master differential equation here. And if you set alpha to 2 log t and you set h to quadratic, the 3 comes out. All right? And moreover, this captures mirror descent, accelerated version, cubic regular Newton, all known, that I know at least, continuous time versions of accelerated algorithms are in that equation. So that's interesting. But even more interesting, there's a one-line proof of convergence rate for this. It's a Lyapunov function, and you just take the derivative in one line, and you get the convergence rate once and for all. It's not optimal. So I had mysteries on the next slide. I'm not ready to tell you something about that. If log t is put here, this thing just recovers gradient flow. That's not optimal. If you put 2 log t, it recovers the Nesterov equation, which is optimal. Right? Now, here's the interesting fact is that, so suppose you said, I'm going to go at rate 1 over t. And so you put it into these equations, the machinery will give you back gradient flow. You'll rediscover it. Now you will move along a certain path in phase space, that, say that solid line. You know, Andrea comes along and says, no, I'm going to go at rate 1 over t squared. So he puts it into this machinery, it'll deliver the Nesterov equation. But here's the cool part, it'll move along exactly the same path as you move along. All right? And so all that's happening is he's using a different watch. He's moving faster, but it's not, who cares? Now Mark comes and says, oh, I want to move exponentially fast. So he makes alpha t just be t. All right, he will get a differential equation, which its solution also follows exactly the same path. So in continuous time, you can move along any rate you want. It's the geometry comes out in the path, not in the speed. All right, but here's what must happen, and this was some mysteries for us about a year ago, is that at some point, so you, me, you and you, the two of you can discretize your differential equation and get out a discrete algorithm, which has the announced rate. Mark will not be able to discretize his differential equation. If he tries, it will be unstable, okay, and that's provable. All right, so we're still kind of working on this, but we're able to kind of understand there's a phase transition as you move from continuous time to discrete. In continuous, you can go as fast as you want, and then there's a transition where you can no longer discretize. All right, and symplectic ideas have been very useful, but they're not the full story yet. So I'm still kind of working on this. Let me just allude to this, that if you know about symplectic integrators, you go from Lagrangian to Hamiltonian, and there's kind of a standard energy conserving notion of integration. And if you just apply that to this problem, here is the convergence of a particular high dimensional f of q. You can see it oscillates, and that is the Oracle rate. So it is just machinery. We've just lowered Lagrange, Lagrangian, Hamiltonian, symplectic. It's just a machine. You don't have to do any algorithm derivation. Moreover, it's just as good as Nesterov. Here's a different function. Here's symplectic and Nesterov. They're going in effectively the same Oracle rate, and then they go a little faster near the optimum. That probably don't have an explanation for. But it's even better than Nesterov. If you turn up the step size, Nesterov goes unstable, and symplectic is still stable. So this is the fastest way I know of to accelerate on these kinds of functions. These things? It's just the function value. We're going down in function value, and the amazing thing about the amazing thing about these algorithms is that they're not descent algorithms. These accelerated ones, they go down, they might come back up, and that seems odd if you're trying to get down the hill as fast as possible. Why should you ever go back up? But if you have a little physics mentality, it's because you build up momentum, and that's good. They might. That's one way they can do it. But they can also kind of oscillate and slosh around a valley. But yeah, they build up momentum in the right way. That's one of the intuitions people have had for 30 years, but it's not mathematics. So,
I lost track. This half the memory? Do you have
it just takes the last two gradients. That's its memory. That's just a particular way of combining two gradients. Yeah.
So in the full phase space, would it be a damped oscillation?
There's two full phase space. The phase space I just talked about, this Hamiltonian is time varying. So we promote that up to a, we lift it to a space in which there's a new energy variable and time, a pseudo time. So in that space, there's a Hamiltonian which is time invariant. So we can apply symplectic integrators. When you project it back down, it's bleeding away energy. But the last mystery here is that the symplectic stuff does not bleed away the energy fast enough. Okay, so in practice, you often will kind of just go down and down and down, and near the end, you'd like to get rid of the energy faster than symplectic will do. So I don't think it's the ultimate answer to the story.
And it can be sort of in terms of the memory?
Yeah.
Is the continuous time have memory then? Or because
it's a second order differential equation. That's it.
Yeah.
XX dot.
Okay. So, but the, when you discretize, then you should have still some speed there, which is not just a. I mean, because at least the standard Nestrel does have memory beyond the last two gradients.
No, it's just the last two gradients. That's it. Yeah, I mean, that's not a discretization, by the way. Nestrov is actually has a rotation, so it's not dynamics. It's some other thing. But there are lots of ways to discretize these things, and some of them, they look different algorithmically. And I think that's kind of probably the problem. People have had this slew of algorithms, but if you go into continuous time, there's a unification. Okay, so let me look at my watch here so I can calculate a little bit. Let's now try to put these two parts of the talk together. What if I'm now accelerating and there are saddle points? So I'm doing this back in the non-convex world. Can I blow past saddle points faster with acceleration? That's been an open question, okay? Your intuition might be as you hit a saddle point, you go back up again and fast and it hurts you, all right? This Hamiltonian approach allowed us to solve this problem, and the Hamiltonian guided the analysis. You looked at pieces of the Hamiltonian and it told you what to analyze when in the analysis. So let me not go into that, but let me just say we were able to get a rate in this case. It is 1 over epsilon to the 7/4. So now we're in the non-convex case. We're doing this Nesterov-style thing. We're doing it in continuous time, and the rate is faster than 1 over epsilon squared. So we provably are getting past saddle points quicker in high dimensions with acceleration than without. Okay, so that's even more motivation for wanting to use acceleration. All right, now we try to return to the last part of the talk, which is what if we now blend this back to stochastics? Why do we want to do stochastics? Well, we already know we need some stochastics to get good rates anyway, so let's be more thoroughly stochastic. Plus, if we're statisticians, we're going to have sample data, and we have to be stochastic for that reason. All right, so this first little piece of work just said, can we accelerate diffusions? In other words, we know we can accelerate differential equations. We've just shown that. Can we accelerate stochastic differential equations? Okay, there's Langevin, which is just a gradient descent. Is there an accelerated version of that? Okay, so I'm not aware of that having been studied or asked. I'm not aware if there's lower bounds and so on. This is something physicists may be able to tell me, but I don't think there are. So instead of looking at overdamped diffusions, those are of the classical Langevin style, let's look at underdamped diffusions, and I'll show you what I mean by that. Can we get faster rates by doing that? All right, so here's overdamped Langevin. It's just that stochastic differential equation right there. I'm using U instead of F now. But anyway, it's Brownian motion added to the gradient. And Lenka told me she's going to be talking much more about Langevin later. You'll probably see this again. So there's a diffusion, and you can discretize it. And are there rates? Yeah, but they're very recent. So Dallaglione in Paris was the first that I'm aware of. In total variation, the rate is 1 over epsilon squared, and there's a d dependence in the numerator. Okay, this is the rate of a diffusion going downhill. Okay, you can ask, is that diffusion going as fast as possible? All right. These are for overdamped Langevin. What if you look at underdamped Langevin? So let's define that to be a second-order SDE, where we add Brownian motion to the velocity, and we integrate the velocity. Okay, so let's call that underdamped Langevin. All right, can you analyze that? Yes, you can, and here's the rate. It is 1 over not epsilon squared, but 1 over epsilon, so that's way faster, but even more importantly, the d goes to square root of d. All right, now I do not know if this is a lower bound. We do not know. We don't have really a notion of diffuse as fast as possible. Most of the MCMC literature has been based on reversible chains. They go forward and backward with equal probability, and that just slows them down. Okay, so we really want to get something that's not reversible, and we're going as fast as possible. The idea here, again, this is a harder proof. This is a coupling argument, but it's a reflection coupling, critically. So a classical coupling is just two Brownian motions that hit at some point. Here we have one Brownian motion, we have a mirror, and we have the reflection of that Brownian motion. And they're going like this. And now we take a line between the two of them, and we take the norm of that line. So now we've reduced the problem to one dimension, and we just do Itô calculus on that object. So I think I had a little slide here. Yeah, we do Itô calculus on the difference between my two reflected diffusions. We just break that apart into the usual Itô terms, and we're able to analyze them all separately and put it back together to get a rate. So that's how that was done. So that kind of took the high-dimensional problem and turned it into one dimension by this particular coupling argument. Okay, and so I'm now back to where I started the talk. With all that machinery, continuous time, diffusions, and the coupling arguments, that's how we were able to prove, with a little bit of help from kind of Gauss-Poincaré lemma, we're able to prove the result that I alluded to earlier. Now we recognize all the colleagues there, Yan Ma, Niladri, and Sheng. Okay, so here's the one more little teaser. There's a paper we're about ready to put on the archive, which is that, what is this underdamped Langevin? Is it a new, brand new thing? And, you know, maybe it's probably been studied in physics, I'm sure it has, but as an algorithm, is it something new? And I think it is, but it has an interpretation. So underdamped Langevin stochastic differential equation, the two pieces in continuous time, is in fact a form of Nesterov acceleration on the manifold of probability distributions. Okay? All right, so there's a paper about it to come out on that. With Chi and Lydia, we've been looking at, all this talk has been on these nice smooth functions. There's no jitter in the functions. If that's the population risk and you sample data, you will get an empirical risk which has a lot of jitter. Okay, so that's the thing we've been talking about all the talk, but the actual object in real life looks like that because you've sampled data from this. You don't have the population. All right, now if you run all these algorithms on this, you can ask what happens. Does everything I talked about break down? And the answer is no. So this paper quantifies that you don't in fact lose anything in the rates that I've talked about. The D dependence and the epsilon dependence is exactly the same. And there's actually a phase diagram of the Mark kind for this problem. All right, but in my last 2 minutes, I'm gonna.
Yes,
of course it does. That's right. So I'm being a statistician now, and I'm just bringing the big hammer of stochastic empirical process theory, sort of saying those fluctuations are order of 1 over square root of n. Okay, so that's not true in complete generality, but it's true for IID sampling in particular. So uniformly over this space, I have fluctuations of size 1 over n. And then I quantify that against all my other constants in the problem, make sure I didn't lose anything. Okay, this is where I'm going to be spending the last part of my career. I got maybe 20 years left. But this is where I think it's all at. I'm tired of gradient descent and tired of neural nets and so on. So I want to work on problems that involve not just one agent, an AI system learning in its world. Okay, other people might find that fine. I'm tired of it. I'm interested in lots and lots of agents, like hundreds of thousands of them all interacting, and they have to give and take, like an economy. What new mathematical challenges do we have to worry about here? Well, first of all, just one little provocation, which is that if you ask people like up on Mars, looking down at the Earth, what do you see that down there that's intelligent? What intelligent systems currently exist on the planet Earth? Well, the first thing I'm sure that, suppose they're trying to build a computer up there and they're trying to make an AI computer that's super intelligent. So what do they look for inspiration on the Earth? Well, surely they will do what everybody else does and says, well, those things are intelligent. Let's try to mimic what's happening in their brain. I believe I was in a neuroscience department for quite a long time. I believe we've made zero progress effectively in understanding intelligence from the brain. Okay, we're going to understand Alzheimer's and maybe how to do this kind of thing, but we are with all due respect, with edge detection that was around in 1960, we still don't understand it really, and learning and forget it and thinking So I think it'll be hundreds of years before we get there, and in psychology similarly, I think we're very, very far from that. All right, so you can think that's the way to go and try to put that stuff in a computer. I just don't think that's the answer. In fact, neural nets did not come from neurons. It's really just control theory. It's layers of, it's control theory. And stochastic gradient came from, the 50s statisticians trying to do optimization. It didn't come from the brain. So maybe that's a little too provocative for you, but that's what I believe. So anyway, the Martian looking down at the Earth, what else down on the Earth is intelligent that you might want to put in your computer? Principles you can see down there that lead to intelligence. Is there anything else on Earth that's intelligent? Huh?
Ants.
Arguably answer.
It says
not able to reason or to abstract or whatever. Squirrels, they're impressive, but they're but yeah, I would argue that markets. So think about the city of San Francisco every day. Actually, Paris is an example. Emile Zola wrote a book called Le Ventre de Paris, which is about all the food that comes into Paris every day. And it's not organized any way, just each individual makes a decision about what lettuce to bring from here to here, how to price it, and so on. So, you know, millions of uncoupled decisions lead to every day the right amount of food arrives at the right place at the right time in a city. And that happens not just in Paris, it happens in every city around the world, and it's been happening for centuries. That's intelligence by any definition of intelligence. It's robust, it's adaptive, it just works, okay? Well, there's always crises in intelligent systems. I don't know, we have a lot of crises called epilepsy and mental health and diseases and so on. Intelligence means working in the real world, and those real world perturbations will make crises happen. Okay? If you're not up against the edge of crisis, then you're not really doing it. Anyway, I don't think, these principles are like microeconomics, and I don't see any AI person trying to put those principles into the AI systems. Yeah, that's an exaggeration, but it's just not there nearly as much as all this other stuff. All right, so I think that you can work on this. So in particular, how do you find Nash equilibria in high dimensions? So if you have a generic function of some kind, the saddle points that are Nash equilibria are axis parallel. One agent wants to go uphill, the other one wants to go downhill. All right, if you take that same thing and rotate it a little bit, that's not a Nash equilibrium. But gradient-based algorithms will find those things just as well as they'll find Nash equilibria, and that's no good. So can I get gradient-based algorithms which will find these kind of saddle points and not these? Okay, so that's not been studied. Kind of shocking. So people have studied algorithms that try to hit Nash equilibrium, but there's only like one saddle point. And they found that that's already hard. You will get lots of limit cycle oscillations just out of basic gradient algorithms. So people do two time scale algorithms and all sorts of things. But the real problem is that I've got a high dimensional space. Even if I put a few Nash equilibria down, I'm certainly topologically going to get a whole bunch of these other kind. And it's going to run aground if I try. So we've been working on that. Here's another problem, two-way markets. What if I'm doing a recommendation system and I'm recommending things to everybody in the room, like restaurants to go to, but if all you go to the same restaurant, then I created congestion. So I have to balance it in some way, but I don't want to balance it in a stupid way. I want to balance it based on what you want. Some of you want to go to Mexican restaurants, some Chinese, so I want to actually use that as part of my, so I build a two-way market as part of a recommendation system. All right, so those two words have never been put together that I'm aware of. Market people make market designs, but there's no statistics and learning there. Recommendation people build recommendation systems with all kinds of data, but there's no market there. Right? You put the two together and it becomes a brand new kind of market that's not been studied, and it's super interesting. And I think that's actually a very real world problem. When you move beyond Amazon and books and movies and you try to make actual recommendations like of paths to go to the airport or stock purchases and all, there's anything with scarcity. You need to have a market mentality. So to just say briefly, here's an example of a problem we've worked on, which is that here's a little space in which there are some Nash equilibria. Those are the green things there. And there is a blue thing, which is a non-Nash equilibrium. So if I were to actually show you the saddle point, it's oriented like this. So we have a new algorithm, which is gradient-based, but not just gradients. It has a little memory. And it heads off towards the non-Nash equilibrium. That's the red curve here. And then it moves away and finds a Nash equilibrium. Standard classical gradient descent, which is the dark black one, goes straight and hits that bad equilibrium. Okay, so I'm going to leave that as a mystery. It's on the archive, but there is an algorithm which does this, and it has a provable rate for this situation. All right, so I am done. I think that's all I wanted to say. This is a slide I've been using for 15 years, but let me just put it up there for the heck of it. This field has come a long way, but I don't think it's yet an engineering discipline. And that's what everyone is kind of claiming we have, this technology of AI. Engineering discipline is something like chemical engineering or civil engineering, which grew out of physics, both of them, both cases. But a chemical engineer said, we got physics, we got chemistry, we know how to pour things into test tubes and get a new material to come out, but how do you build that at scale so it really works and it doesn't explode, it don't have crises, and it's economically viable and anybody can build it? That was a whole field that emerged over decades called chemical engineering, right? And I think it's the exact same thing here. We have some proto-principles of information theory and physics and math and all that, and we know how to kind of build little gadgets, but we don't have anything like an engineering discipline, which says, how do you take data flows at large scale and computational ideas and build them together so a system really works and makes life better for large numbers of people in medicine, transportation, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a huge disconnect between the promises of AI and what we actually have as an academic field. Thanks.
So we have some time for questions and comments.
Okay, three hands went up simultaneously. All right.
So I was wondering whether you could explain a bit better this issue with the instability of discretization when you construct the because I think this is something.
Yeah, and I wish I could, really. I thought that symplectic ideas would just kind of nail this somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, symplectic ideas, you have, I'm trying to go along and discretize a flow, right, a path. And the symplectic ideas have, there's always error terms from like forward Euler and backward Euler. And if you put the two together, they cancel in a way. You get higher order accuracy. And that allows you to take larger step size and stay more stable. And I thought that would give the phase transition, that it would tell you at some point that you still lose stability even under the symplectic integrator. But that has not happened to be the case. So I think it's still a mystery, and I think it's really a fantastic one. There's something about the geometry that means at certain speeds, there's just no way to integrate and retain that speed. You can integrate more slowly and lose the rate. All right, so yeah, we're really on the hunt for sufficient and necessary conditions for being able to discretize differential equations. And, you know, symplectic ideas went back to Hamilton and Jacobi and Poincaré, so I thought those guys would have nailed it, and they did nail a lot, but they just this part, it wasn't enough. So some other idea needed. I don't know what it is.
Other questions?
Yeah, I'm in the back.
So I missed the title of your upcoming paper, but I noticed you had something about the KL divergence in there.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you're familiar, like there's been some physics work the past 5 years where they use this concept of information geometry.
I know information geometry well, yes. I know
to talk
Amari
about like finding the right variables to...
Yeah.
Do you think there's any connection to like your momentum term? Like, is it like finding
I've not been a big
variable?
Fan of information geometry. It's to me just the exponential family in different language, and it's not really that geometrically deep, but you know, I shouldn't say that on a video, but I've not gotten a lot out of it. It's just kind of new the same ideas in new language. So this is a continuous time. And KL divergence is being used as the metric on a probability manifold, and it just doesn't feel like information geometry, but point me to it afterwards. I'd love to make sure I see it.
Other questions?
Down in front.
So it'd be very interesting to try some of these for molecular geometry optimization. So our favorite methods at the moment for minimization are limited memory LBFGS type procedures.
Yeah.
And for transition states hybrid eigenvector following. And they're both hardware dependent. So the number of memories that is optimal for LBFGS, for example, on CPU can be hundreds or thousands for a big system. But on GPU, it's 5 to 10. Have you thought about any of the hardware?
Thought about it a bit. I mean, our field has looked at LBFGS for 40 years now, and it's never won out over the simple stochastic gradient. We always continue to return, and Nadi can say more about this, but we keep thinking we'll return or even go into Hessian kind of world, and we just never get there. It's amazing stochastic gradient is just so effective, and it's largely because of the lack of dimension dependence. It's kind of part of the phenomenon, but you know, I have some papers on LBFGS. They never win out. Nobody ever uses them. So, but that could change. You're absolutely right. The hardware could shift everything. Yeah.
So, when you compared Nestor acceleration, you had a different method. Also, it enjoyed the same rate, but seemed to be more stable in terms of step size.
Yeah.
Which, is that? I just want to understand what's going on there. Is that guaranteed to have the same optimal performance as Nestor?
Yeah.
Or
it's guaranteed, but it's. So let me just say, I think you'll find that Nesterov, remember the second equation is a linear combination of things,
right.
A 1 minus some t and plus on t. Make that t be cosine and sine. That step is actually a rotation. Okay? So it's not following it can't be a gradient algorithm. It's a rotation, right?
What do you mean by gradient algorithm? I mean, it's based on the gradient. It's not following the gradient direction.
It's not following it. It's not the gradient of anything. It's not gradient of potential functions. It has a rotation in it. And it's not gotten from discretizing some differential equation, because it has this rotation in it. But somehow the rotation is helpful. But when you turn up the step size, that rotation, I think, really hurts you.
Right.
All right, but this is all intuition at this point, and these are kind of mysteries to me. So Nesterov had this brilliant idea. He wrote down this algorithm, and he could analyze it, but there was no you know, underlying dynamical perspective that led to that algorithm, which is the brilliance of Nesterov. And he brilliantly somehow put in a rotation without even thinking it probably is a rotation. And it just all worked out.
No, I think it came from thinking of two-dimensional optimization. So.
Yeah, no, yeah, probably. But yeah, it's been 40 years, and we're all kind of still in a jumble about it.
But that algorithm that is obtained as a discretization of a continuous time dynamic.
Yeah.
Does enjoy the same.
It does enjoy the same rate.
Guarantees.
Yes,
and it seems
1/k squared. Yeah.
Okay. So thank you. Okay, so, yes.
Okay,
we're missing the next speaker, so. So we have 45 minutes of discussion. No? Okay, so well, the lunch will be served in 45 minutes, so well, now we can, well, break into groups and continue discussing. So thank you for all the speakers of this morning's session.